I woke again under the awning on the deck of Thanos' flagship. I found myself lying on a sheepskin mattress, with Thanos leaning over me. As soon as he saw that I was conscious, he masked the expression of concern and worry that had twisted his features. "You crazy old fool!" he forced a grin at me. "What in the name of Horus were you laughing about?" I tried to sit up, but my head ached abominably, and I groaned, then clutched his arm as it all came back to me. "Thanos, the enemy horses that swam across last night. I must have them." "Don't worry, that battered head of yours. I've already sent Huey to gather them up," he assured me. "If I am to have 500 of those contraptions of yours for my new chariot division, I will need 1,000 of those cursed brutes to pull them. However, those newfangled wheels of yours are more dangerous than a regiment of Hyksos. I will not ride with you again until you do something about them." For a moment it did not penetrate my aching skull. Then I realized that it had happened. Thanos had quashed his pride and given in to me. My orphan chariot squadron was at last to be part of the standing army, and he would give me the men and gold to build 500 more. He would even ride with me again, if only I could fix my wheels. But what truly filled me with joy was that he had forgiven me at last, and we were friends once more. The success of my chariots at Esna and the feeling of confidence that it instilled in us all were short-lived. Secretly, I had expected and dreaded what would happen next. It was the enemy's logical move, and both Salatus and Lord Intef should have made it much earlier. I knew that when he swept through the Lower Kingdom, Salatus had captured most of the fleet of the Red Pretender intact. Those ships were lying abandoned in the docks of Memphis and Tanis in the Delta. However, there must be droves of renegade Egyptians from the usurper's navy available to Salatus. And even if that were not the case, it would certainly be possible to recruit enough mercenary Syrian sailors in Gaza and Joppa, and the other ports along the eastern coast of the Great Sea, to man several hundred of these galleys and transports. I had realized that this must happen, but I had refrained from warning either Thanos or my mistress of the likelihood, for I did not wish to add to the feeling of gloom and heighten the despondency of our people. I had searched my heart for a counter to this move when Salatus and Intef made it, but there was none that I could think of. Therefore, since I could do nothing to allay these fears, I thought it best to keep them to myself. When it finally happened, and our spies on the east side of the river opposite Asyot warned us of the approach of this fleet from the delta, Thanos rushed his own ships northwards to meet them. His fleet was superior in every way to the one which Salatus and Intef had assembled, but the battle they fought lasted for almost a week before Thanos destroyed or drove them back into the delta. However, Salatus had brought his transports up behind the screen of fighting galleys, and while the river battle still raged, he was able to embark almost 2 full regiments of horse and chariot and ferry them intact to our side of the river, without our galleys being able to reach them. These regiments comprised nearly 300 of Salatus' fast war chariots, his elite divisions which he led himself. At last he had turned our flank. There was nothing to stop him now, as his chariots came bowling southwards along our side of the river. All our galleys could do was to try to keep pace with the dust cloud he threw up as he raced for the funerary temple of Mimosa and all its treasures. Queen Lostris called her war council when the news of the Hyksos crossing reached us in the palace of Memnon. She addressed her first question to Thanos. "Now that he is across the river, can you check the barbarian?" "I can slow him down, perhaps," he replied frankly. "We have learned a great deal about him. We can wait for him behind walls of stone, or behind barriers of the sharp staves that Taita has equipped us with. But Salatus need not give battle. His chariots are so fast that he can swing around our positions as he did at Asyut. No, I cannot stop him." Queen Lostris looked at me. "Taita, what about your chariots? Can they not give battle to the Hyksos?" "Your Majesty, I have 40 chariots that I can send in to meet him. He has 300. My chariots are swifter than those of Salatus, but my men cannot match his in skill and training. There is also the matter of the wheels. I have not perfected them. Salatus will overwhelm and destroy us very easily. If I am given the time and the material, I can build new and better chariots with wheels that do not burst, but I cannot replace the horses. We dare not risk the horses. They are our only hope for eventual victory." While we thus debated, another messenger arrived, this time from the south. He had fled to us on the current and the wind, so his news was only a day old. Tanos ordered him into the council chamber, and the messenger fell to his knees before Queen Lostris. "Speak, fellow," Tanos invited him. "What do you have to tell us?" The messenger stuttered in fear of his life. "Divine Majesty, while our fleet was busy at Asyut, the barbarian made another crossing at Esna. They swam the horses over as they did before, but this time there were none of our galleys ready to turn back their boats. Two Hyksos regiments are across. Their horses are in the traces, and they are coming on a cloud of dust, swiftly as the flight of the swallow. They will be here in 3 days." None of us spoke, until Tanos had sent the man away with orders that he be fed and cared for. The messenger, who had expected to be killed, kissed Queen Lostri's sandals. When we were alone, Tanos said softly, "Salitus has 4 regiments across the river, 600 chariots. It is over." "No." My mistress's voice shook with the force of her denial. "The gods cannot desert this very Egypt now. Our civilization cannot perish. We have too much to give to the world." "I can fight on, of course," Tanos agreed. "But in the end it will be the same. We cannot prevail against their chariots." My mistress turned back to me. "Taita, I have not asked you before because I know how dearly it costs you. But I must ask you now before I make the final decision. I ask you to work the mazes of Amun-Ra for me. I must know what the gods require of us." I bowed my head in acquiescence and whispered, "I will fetch my chest." The site that I chose for the divination was the inner sanctuary of the Shrine of Horus in the half-completed palace of Memnon. The shrine had not yet been dedicated to the god, and his image had not yet been set up, but I was certain that Horus had already cast his benevolent influence over the building. My mistress sat before me with Tanos at her side, and watched in fascination as I drank the witch's potion to open the eyes of my soul, my ka, the little bird-like creatures that lives in the heart of every one of us, and which is our alter ego. I laid the ivory mazes before them and asked both Queen Lostris and Tanos to stroke and handle them, to endow them with their spirit and the spirit of the nation that they represented, this very Egypt. As I watched them divide the stacks of ivory counters, I felt the drug in my blood grow stronger, and the beat of my heart slowed as the little death crept over me. I took up the 2 remaining mazes from the last stack, and I held them to my breast. They began to grow hot against my skin, and my instinct was to draw back from the darkness that I felt coming over me. Instead, I surrendered to it and let it carry me away. I heard my mistress's voice, as though from a great distance. "What will become of the double crown? How can we resist the barbarian?" The visions began to form before my eyes, and I was carried up into the days that were still to come, and I saw events that had not yet come to pass. The morning sunlight was streaming through the aperture in the roof and striking the altar of Horus when at last I returned from the far journey of the mazes. I was shaken and nauseated with the effect of the hallucinatory drug, giddy and trembling with the memories of the strange sights that I had seen. My mistress and Tanos had stayed with me during the long night. Their anxious faces were the first things that I saw on my return, but they were still so distorted and wavering that I thought they were part of the vision. "Taita, are you all right? Speak to us. Tell us what you saw." My mistress was concerned. She could not hide the guilt she felt at having forced me to enter the mazes of Amun-Ra once more. "There was a serpent." My voice still echoed strangely in my own ears, as though I stood apart. "A great green serpent that crawled through the desert." I saw the puzzled expression on their faces, but I had not yet considered the meaning of it all myself, so I could give them no guidance. "I am thirsty," I whispered. "My throat is dry and my tongue like a stone covered with moss." Tanos fetched a jar of wine and poured it into the bowl for me, and I drank greedily. "Tell us of the serpent," my mistress demanded as soon as I lowered the bowl. "There was no end to its sinuous body, and it shimmered green in the sunlight. It crawled through a strange land in which lived tall, naked men and strange and wonderful beasts." "Could you see the head or the tail of the serpent?" my mistress asked, and I shook my head. "Where were you? Where did you stand?" she insisted. I had forgotten how keenly she enjoyed my visions, and what pleasure she took in interpreting them. "I was riding upon the back of the serpent," I answered. but I was not alone. Who was with you? You were at my side, mistress, and Memnon with you. Tanos was on my other hand, and the serpent carried us all. The Nile! The serpent was the river, she cried triumphantly. You foresaw a voyage that we were making upon the river. Which way? Tanos demanded. He was as rapt as she was. Which way did the river run? I made an effort to recall every detail. I saw the sun rise on my left hand. South, he cried. Into Africa, said my mistress. At last I saw the heads of the serpent ahead of us. The body of the serpent was bifurcated, and on each branch was a head. Does the Nile have two branches? My mistress wondered aloud. Or is there some deeper meaning to the vision? Let us hear the rest of what Taita has to tell us, Tanos stopped her speculation. Continue, old friend. Then I saw the goddess, I went on. She sat upon a high mountain. Both the heads of the serpent worshipped her. My mistress could not restrain herself. Which of the goddesses did you see? Oh, tell me quickly who it was. She had the bearded head of a man, but the breasts and the pudenda of a woman. From her vagina she spurted out two great streams of water into the open mouths of the double-headed serpent. It is the goddess Hapi, the river god, Queen Lostris whispered. She generates the river within herself and pours it out to flow through the world. What else did the vision show you? Tanos demanded. The goddess smiled at us, and her face shone with love and benevolence. She spoke in a voice that was the sound of the wind and the sea, the sound of thunder on the peaks of faraway mountains. What did she say to us? Queen Lostris asked in awe. She said, Let my child come to me. I will make her strong so that she will prevail, and my people will not perish in the face of the barbarian. I repeated the words that still beat like a drum in my head. I am the child of the river goddess, said my mistress simply. At birth I was dedicated to her. Now she summons me, and I must go to the place where she dwells, at the end of the Nile. This is the same voyage that Taita and I contemplated once before, Tanos mused. And now the goddess commands it. We cannot refuse her. Yes, we must go, but we will come back, my mistress vowed. This is my land, this very Egypt. This is my city, this beautiful Thebes of the Hundred Gates. I cannot leave them forever. I will return to Thebes. This I swear, and I call upon the goddess Hapi to witness my oath. We shall return. The decision to fly to the south, up above the cataracts, into the wild and unexplored land beyond, was one that Tanos and I had made once before. The first time had been to escape the wrath and vengeance of Pharaoh. Now we were flying from an even more merciless foe. It was almost as though the gods were determined that we should undertake this voyage, and that they should not be denied. There was little time for us to make our preparations for such a fateful departure. The Hyksos were coming down on us from two directions, and our pickets reported that their cohorts would be in view from the roof of the palace of Memnon within 3 days at the very latest. Tanos placed Kratos in charge of half his available force and sent him to meet King Salatus, who was driving hard from Assyot in the north and was likely to be the first column to reach the necropolis and the palace. Kratos had orders to fight a running battle. Using the staves and defending every fortified position, he was to delay Salatus as long as was possible, without risking being cut off or overwhelmed. When he could hold them no longer, he was to evacuate his men onto the galleys. Tanos himself took the other half of our army and moved south to fight another delaying battle against the Hyksos division coming at us from Esna. While they were thus engaged, my mistress was to embark our people and all their possessions aboard the remaining ships of our fleet. My mistress delegated this duty to Lord Mekaset, but of course she made me his assistant. Lord Mekaset was not only well into his dotage, but had recently taken to himself a 16-year-old wife. He was not therefore of much use either to himself or to me. The entire planning and execution of the evacuation fell squarely on my shoulders. However, before I could turn my mind to this, I had to take care of my horses. Even at this early stage, I realized with stark clarity that they were the key to our survival as a nation and a civilized people. With those animals that we had captured at Esna, we now had several thousand in our herd. I split this herd into four parts, so that they could more readily find grazing on the march.